Our team was led by David McAteer, who had been the head of the Mine Safety and Health Administration, MSHA, during the Clinton administration. And we released our report in May of this year. And there's my disclosure. Our work was guided by a statement that we heard from one of the victim's family members who told us simply, just tell us what happened. In the next 15 minutes, I want to share with you just some basic information about the way the mine was laid out. I want to describe the technical issues that contributed to the disaster and the company culture and norms that caused the disaster. Just briefly, if you were able to cut off the top of a mountain and open it up and look down inside, this is what the Upper Big Branch mine looked like. So it was an expansive area. Most of these sections here had been mined out many years earlier. And the area where the active mining was taking place was in this area here. The men entered the mine either at this portal or this portal, depending on, you know, which area they were going to be working in. The mine is made up of a series of tunnels, which we call entries, that have intersecting tunnels, and that's where the ventilation flows through. These areas here that are the older mined out areas, those were mined out with longwall mining, where they are actually taking huge swaths of coal and the mountain collapses down inside of it. Where this other type, these are also mined out areas, but they're narrow tunnels held up by both the coal pillars that are left in place as well as steel roof supports. So this just gives you an idea of what the mine looked like. Just briefly, longwall mining, you have a large pillar of coal that you're trying to mine out, and you have hydraulic roof supports here where the men are working under those roof supports. The coal is cut in this way, it falls into conveyor and comes out of the mine, and then as those hydraulics move forward, as you're cutting the coal, the material collapses behind it. And we call this area the gob, and so you have, you know, you continue to have the methane building up back in that area. This is us kind of drilling down into that area where the men were working. You had this longwall panel where there were 12 miners on that crew. And then you had two crews, a crew of 9, a crew of 10. And they were building these additional sections here on this side and this side, which were designed to be the new head gate and tail gate for this longwall. So this panel was nearly completed. And it needs to move. This is your money maker in the machine, in the mine. This is where the money is made because you can cut so much coal. And the mine was falling behind. These crews had run into trouble both with bad top and just the geology in the mine. There were problems with water. And this mine was just not engineered properly, and so they were running behind. There was a lot of concern, particularly by mine management, that we're going to run out of room and we don't have a place to put our money maker. And so that's kind of the mentality that was going on at the mine at the time. One of the most fundamental principles of mine safety is ventilation. You need enough air flowing through the mine, particularly to the areas where the miners are cutting the coal, where you have coal dust and methane. You need that to be swooped away from that area and pushed out through what we call return entry, which moves around. And the more sections you have in the mine, you know, the more diligent you need to be that each of those working sections is being ventilated properly. So this describes what was going on about the 6 months area before this is where the men were working. On Monday, April 5th, which was the day of the disaster, it was Easter Monday. The mine had been closed down because it had been the Easter holiday. The men came back to work for the regular shift starting at about 6 a.m. They reported to their sections. The longwall crew made a couple of passes on the longwall, but they ran into mechanical problems with the shear, and it was down most of the day while they were making repairs till about 2:30 p.m. The other miners, both on this headgate and tailgate section, just had kind of a typical day at the mine, and were getting ready to, head out of the mine for the 30-minute ride out at the end of their shift. .302 came up, and as one miner described, that's when the world came to an end. Based on the physical evidence, here's what we believe happened. As the shear cut into sandstone rock in the mine roof, the resulting sparks ignited a pocket of methane, creating a fireball. The fireball in turn ignited the methane that had accumulated in the gob over the Easter weekend and leaked onto the longwall face. The fireball traveled into the tailgate area where accumulations of coal dust provided fuel for subsequent more deadly blasts, ricocheting in different directions. And actually, if you follow the path of the explosion, it actually traveled for about 7 miles in total. The victims of the blast included the 12 men on the longwall, the 9 men up in this headgate section, as well as there were 9 men on this man trip who had left their section and were traveling out of the mine. They were about a mile from the explosion. And of the 9 men, 7 died, 2 survived, but 1 has severe brain injury from carbon monoxide poisoning. I wanted those to scroll through, but you can just see the magnitude, the numbers of individuals, and you think about behind each of those individuals are their family members, their friends, their coworkers. So I'll describe for you now the key technical problems that led to the death of those 29 men. Upper Big Branch mine management failed to develop and implement an effective mine ventilation plan. Miners testify continuously that on the active mining sections there was inadequate ventilation, and when they complained loudly enough to management about it, management would make temporary changes that would actually just steal air from other sections. Federal and state mine inspectors also recognized a serious problem. In all of 2009, this mine received violations from both federal and state mine inspectors every month for serious ventilation problems, including violations where the air was traveling in the wrong direction. The mine had problems with water building up in the entries. This area far beyond the longwall, here's where the men were working, all of these entries, there was a drain or a sump pump back in this area. They had water building up in these entries, and they actually had a whole bunch of water pumps that were trying to keep that water down and flowing back towards the drain. It wasn't graded properly, so it didn't flow. And you can just imagine as your key areas where your ventilation needs to flow through, if water starts rising, how that's going to impede your ventilation. The Red Hat miners, the new miners that were assigned to work in that area where the pumps were set, testified that they would often be up to water up to their knees, and from time to time it would be up to their chests. Again, it doesn't take much to imagine how that would impede your ventilation. Moreover, we had evidence that the pumps over the Easter weekend had failed. Another mine safety fundamental is using water sprays on the cutting tools to extinguish sparks, to keep the equipment cool, and to control the coal dust. And effective water sprays would provide a fine mist so that it can perform those functions. At Upper Big Branch on this shear, which is on the long wall, too many water sprays were plugged or missing, and we attributed the clogged sprays to the mine operator pulling water from the big coal river outside of the mine. They were pulling water into the mine to use water on the shear, and if that water is not filtered properly, you have sediment from the river water that builds up in the water sprays. And the gushing water that you see here, not the fine mist, but the gushing water, is probably attributed to the miners trying to widen those nozzles in some way so that they could get some water on the shear. But by doing so, it created this gusher rather than the fine water spray that you needed. Veteran miners will also tell you that you need rock dust. They'll say you can never have enough rock dust. Pulverized calcium carbonate, which is limestone, is used in the mine to reduce the combustibility of the coal dust. And in this mine, the check marks here represent the month or so before the disaster and all the times that miners identified when more rock dust is needed. Those are the check marks. The red marks are the times when that was actually done, when management actually ensured that more rock dust was applied. So of the 561 times where miners said, we need more rock dust here, only 12% of the time were those requests ever followed through on. Management enlisted only a two-person crew for that whole huge mine, a two-person crew to apply rock dust. They worked on that task part-time. They were often pulled off onto other jobs. This is the machine that they had, and these hoses didn't work. They were clogged. It's just a crappy piece of equipment. It dated back to 1980 when the mine was purchased from the previous operator. And this was the old machine they used for spare parts. One of the men who was assigned to do the rock dusting wrote in a record book just a couple of weeks before the disaster, "I'm set up here to fail." That statement exemplifies the critical intersection between the engineering and the technical problems at Upper Big Branch and the norms and cultures of the company that foster deviance. Normalization of deviance refers to the gradual process which unacceptable practices become acceptable. The terms used by sociologist Diane Vaughan in her examination of the 1986 Challenger space shuttle disaster. As deviant behavior is repeated without any catastrophic results, it becomes a social norm for the organization, and individuals or entities that challenge that norm from within or within or outside of the organization, they're considered nuisances or threats to the organization. And we saw that both with the miners who left the mine because they could not tolerate these situations and they were not considered Massey members anymore. And we see this in the statements made both before and after the disaster by the CEO of the company, Don Blankenship, just criticizing and casting responsibility onto the regulators for the disaster rather than their own corporate responsibility. In our report, we provide example after example of these deviations and actually illegal behavior of the corporation that contributed to the disaster. I'd be happy to discuss any of these with you. Just to illustrate, as one foreman described a situation to us where he took his crew up to the section, they were going to be working on the tailgate section, and when they got up there, the ventilation was woefully inadequate. It was like 1,800 CFM when you need about 20,000 CFM. So immediately he started the men working on some repairs of the ventilation controls. You think of these tunnels, and you have doors and brattice cloths and other things to direct the air to the face where you need it. And so they started making those repairs. It took them about 55 minutes to do so. So they didn't start running coal for about an hour into their shift. The next day when he returned to work, he was asked to report to the superintendent's office, and he was suspended for 3 days for poor work performance. He told us, well, they weren't going to write me up for making the mine safe. He was written up for poor work performance. The miners at Upper Big Branch knew, and there was no question about it, that production was a top priority at the mine. Just a few months before another disaster that occurred at a Massey mine in 2006, the company's CEO, Don Blankenship, sent a memo to all employees saying, if you've been asked by your supervisors or foremen or engineers to do those construction projects, to build those overcasts or stoppings, you should ignore them. Quote, this memo is necessary only because we seem not to understand that coal pays the bills, end quote. Coal miners have known for decades how to prevent coal dust explosions, and those lessons were learned many years ago. The lessons that we seem unwilling to tackle is how we can make corporations responsible for their behavior, and for corporate risk-taking and the profit motive that allows employers to gamble with workers' lives. Thank you.